you know, can we get that done in a day? Yeah, if everything went good.
Republican lawmakers consider creative ways to end the session. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, fixing the holes in the juvenile justice safety net.
Making this a ticketable offense, we hope, will make it easier for officers to write those tickets and will bring these kids to the attention of the justice system.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Republican majorities in the House and Senate are now considering ways to avoid a vote on the Constitutional Budget Reserve. A three-quarter vote is needed to access the fund, and the House's Democratic minority has made their support conditional on priorities like increased education funding and Medicaid expansion. House Speaker Mike Chenault says the legislature may be able to pay for government through October using revenue anticipation bonds or existing pots of money, like the Power Cost Equalization Fund. The Nikiski Republican adds Governor Bill Walker is supportive of that plan.
That's not an option the governor really wants to see, is us leave without a CBR vote. If he would like to help and from his position to get a CBR vote, we'd probably accept that.
Governor Walker, the House Speaker, the Senate President, and the House Minority Leader were all planning to meet today in the same room for the first time since negotiations began. Meanwhile, House Democrats are not on board with the plan to gavel out and circumvent a vote on the Constitutional Budget Reserve. Representative Les Guerra represents an Anchorage district.
Since we couldn't get it done in 90 days, we need to still try and work together to protect public education, to pass things that save the state huge amounts of money, like the $600 million we'd save with Medicaid expansion.
If the vote to access the CBR does not happen, the legislature may have to hold a special session later in the fall to avoid a government shutdown when funds run out. After a five-month hiatus on document production, the Walker administration has released a batch of records related to the Alaska National Guard scandal. The 4,000-page file was sent to news organizations at 3 p.m. on Friday afternoon. Alaska Public Media and the Alaska Dispatch News requested the materials nearly a year ago during the Parnell administration, but were denied access until a Superior Court judge ordered their release in October. Though substance abuse among young people in Anchorage and statewide is troublingly high, some officials see reasons for optimism. All this week, as part of our series, The Blind Spot, Alaska Public Media is exploring holes in the safety net for teens struggling with drugs and alcohol. And as KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, policy solutions are starting to address the problem.
Diane Casto started doing prevention work in Alaska in 1978 and now manages the Division of Behavioral Health. She's part of the state's effort to shift the paradigm on community health, developing new tools to measure what's working.
Just doing a walk around and looking at your community, what's the density of alcohol outlets in your community? What are the policies and procedures and practices in your community related to alcohol and drug issues?
Casto is pushing for a switch in focus, away from reactive intervention and towards prevention.
The more we work on the front end and prevent these issues from becoming catastrophic, the better we will be. We know that prevention and promotion services are much less expensive than getting into treatment, into residential care, and ongoing services.
This is a reap what you sow approach. It cost Casto's division about $9 per person to put on a promotional event, like a health fair. That is a bargain compared to the $50,000 per person it costs to provide long-term care to someone working through acute psychiatric care and recovery. That doesn't mean that every person who stops by a health fair will just say no for their entire life, but on balance, Casto says, prevention is a sounder policy. The Alaska Wellness Coalition has a similar aim. The group is trying to prevent underage drinking by changing community-wide perceptions. The Center for Disease Control's most recent youth risk behavior survey says that 3/4 of youth reported not drinking in the past month. Coalition campaign coordinator Hope Finkelstein says they're using that data to help teens realize drinking is actually not the norm.
And so what this campaign intends to do is start the conversation. And even if people don't believe that 78% of the kids don't drink, that's fine. That is okay because people will start questioning.
Finkelstein says the coalition is finding youth around the state who want to talk about alcohol but haven't been able to. A similar campaign was launched in Homer a few years ago when data showed that people there didn't drink nearly as much as was commonly thought. After the data were released, people didn't believe it, but it got them talking about things. There's also an effort to get kids in trouble better, or at the very least, to develop an improved system from the minor consuming alcohol charges. At the state level, Senate Bill 99 this session attempts to amend Title IV, the alcohol code. The legislation didn't get very far, but sponsors say its introduction sets the wheels in motion for reforms next session. Professor Marnie Rivera at UAA's Justice Center works on the issue and wants the MCA citation to be replaced with a ticket, like the kind you get for speeding or parking.
In working with these statutes over a couple of years and hearing from experts and hearing from prosecutors and hearing from people from DJJ, what we realized is that these MCAs are almost like a gap or this no man's land where DJJ doesn't deal with these youth until they've already come to the attention of the criminal justice system 3 times.
So this might seem kind of counterintuitive. Rivera wants to help at-risk kids by increasing the number of times they get in trouble. She argues that police and lawyers know what a long, drawn-out process it can be to see an MCA go through the courts. And they have hearts. They know an MCA makes your name ping in court view, which can jeopardize a young person's future. So kids get slapped on the wrist without an official citation ever being issued. And Rivera says this is exactly the kind of space where addictive behaviors have room to intensify.
These days, there's very few cases where you actually see a habitual status offender, a third-time minor consuming, because these are actually difficult charges for police officers to deal with. Making this a ticketable offense, we hope, will make it easier for officers to write those tickets and will bring these kids to the attention of the justice system, hopefully in a way that we can screen some of them and determine if some of them already have problems with alcohol that need to be addressed through treatment.
But as many of the experts we spoke to said, there is no silver bullet. Even if the MCA system is improved, some kids will end up back where this series started, at the McLaughlin Youth Center. Ross Blocker stands inside one of the aging treatment cottages on the McLaughlin campus, his fingers interwoven like a nest. He's been in charge of McLaughlin's Transitional Services Unit for a decade, and he wants to make sure kids leave the youth center with the skills they need to make it in the chaotic world beyond the campus.
And you just can't, you know, do all that work and then pat them on the back, put them out the door and say, have a nice day. So what our unit does is take the work that was done with the initial treatment plan. We build a plan around the kid to address all those risk and need elements that are there and how we're going to support that kid in the community. Medical needs, mental health counseling needs, substance abuse needs. If they've gone through intensive substance abuse here, it just makes sense that they need some type of support system there.
Blocker's team coordinates with partners in Anchorage like the school district and the Mental Health Trust and tries to check in on everyone who went through treatment so that they don't leave 24-hour-a-day structure and enter a total vacuum. They try to give young people the support they need to keep them out of the statistics. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, searching for clues to sea star wasting disease in Unalaska.
He was just in these rocks upside down. He's probably trying to get back in the water.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group. The Smiles for Life Foundation helps fund children's charities and humanitarian work. Learn more at smilealaska.com. And by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
A national movement to opt out of standardized testing has hit the Haines School District. That put the district well below the federal mandate of 95% participation, which could put thousands of dollars in grant funding at risk. KHNS's Emily Files reports.
This is catching me completely by surprise.
That's Haines Superintendent Ginger Jewell. About a week into the Alaska Measures of Progress, or AMP, testing, six students had opted out. A few days later, it was 12. Before we get into why this is happening, here's some background. School districts around the U.S. are required by federal law to assess student progress with testing each year.
The reason why we have that in place, why that is in place, is because it's an accountability measure to make sure that students are receiving an education as defined by the state.
Elizabeth Davis is the administrator for student assessments with the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development, or EED. The AMP tests are new this year. Before, the tests were called SBAs, standard-based assessments. The AMP tests are aligned with new state education standards adopted in 2012. They're conducted online instead of with a pencil and paper. Davis says new education standards are more rigorous and emphasize critical thinking. Most states around the U.S. have adopted the Common Core state standards in their curriculum and tests. Alaska is not one of them, but some parents and even legislators see a difference between Common Core and Alaska standards only in name, not in substance. That is a central reason for the increasing number of test refusals.
And so there's a group of people who feel like their students shouldn't take this test because it's a Common Core test, which would be an inaccurate statement.
A group called Alaskans Against the Common Core did not return requests for comment, but one Haines parent did explain his reasons for opting his children out of the AMP tests this year. He asked not to be identified or recorded to protect his children's privacy. He says his main concern about the testing is also privacy. He says AMP is aligned with Common Core, and his understanding of Common Core's purpose is to track students through their schooling and into their career, and then that data is available to be sold to companies that are recruiting.
Absolutely not. We do not sell student data, period.
Brian Laurent is the data supervisor for EED.
Any transfer of information, student-level information, from our test vendor in Kansas to staff here at the department is done in a secure, encrypted manner. Student data are not in danger of being released.
Haines is not the only school district in Alaska dealing with a huge increase in test refusals. Robin Taylor is the assistant superintendent and testing coordinator for the Sitka School District.
We have a total of 32 student or parent refusals out of 283 testers.
That's a problem because the No Child Left Behind law requires schools to have 95% participation in annual assessments. In normal circumstances, that could drop the school's Alaska School Performance Index rating, which is on a scale of 1 to 5 stars. But since this is the first year for the AMP test, the state is requesting federal approval to freeze schools' star ratings. So at least this year, Haines schools' star ratings might not change. However, with a participation rate below the federal requirement, state officials say the district will still have to develop a plan to bring participation next year back up to 95%. So schools are stuck in the middle of two things they cannot do very much about: federal requirements on test participation and parents' freedom of choice to refuse testing. Districts like Haines and Sitka have tried to put out information to combat worries about AMP testing. Jewel says she's concerned the genie is out of the bottle and that what she calls misinformation will not go away. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
A mysterious virus wiping out sea stars on the West Coast has spread to Southeast Alaska, but not to Southwest. Researchers found that last month in Unalaska and Kodiak. They hope the island's healthy sea stars will give new clues about how the virus works. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has more.
It's low tide on a sandy beach outside Unalaska's Captain's Bay, and local scuba diver Josh Good is wading around in a rocky tide pool. It's full of urchins, kelp, and sponges, but Good is looking for something a little higher up the food chain.
This is a solaster. Okay. Solaster stimpsoni, and they're predatory. They're pretty awesome.
He's holding a 10-legged sea star about a foot wide. It's bright orange with purple stripes. The solaster eats sea cucumbers, but it can be food itself for bigger sea stars.
He was just in these rocks upside down. He's probably trying to get back in the water.
Further out, Good finds more stars of all different shapes and sizes. But there's one thing they have in common. They're healthy. And that's big news when stars up and down the West Coast and into Alaska have been dying off from sea star wasting disease. Ian Hewson is a researcher at Cornell University. He visited on Alaska and Kodiak about a month ago, working with divers like Good to check if local sea stars were infected.
You know, we actually looked at about six different species of sea stars, and we collected samples from four of those and took them back to the lab. And we can confirm that we didn't detect the virus, which is normally associated with this disease, further south.
It's been seen in Homer, Seward, Sitka, Juneau, and Ketchikan. Huge numbers of stars develop lesions, lose limbs, and finally disintegrate into mush. Now Hewson wants to know why that's not happening in Southwest, and he'll study samples from the healthy stars to find out. One theory, he says, is distance.
There's a big break in what's known as biogeography of sea stars between Kodiak and essentially the Kenai Peninsula. It's just a pretty deep stretch of water that not a lot of material goes between them.
That break could protect on Alaska and Kodiak if the virus spreads how Hewson thinks it does on juvenile sea stars. They're spawned in the water, then float away from their parents and usually settle among new populations.
So it's almost as though, you know, you've got the daycare center, if you will. You know, they've obviously got some pathogen out in the environment and they're bringing it home and infecting the adults.
But the virus might not be all that's causing the disease. In the Southwest samples, Hewson says he'll be on the lookout for outside influences that could differ from infected areas.
What we're not terribly sure of is whether, you know, adverse environmental conditions makes it more susceptible to this virus or whether, you know, perhaps it makes the symptoms more obvious to us. And so these are the types of questions that, you know, we're trying to work on.
And it's just the beginning of what they hope to do. If National Science Foundation funding comes through this summer, Hewson's team will be back to the Southwest to collect entire stars. They'll quarantine them and infect them with the virus down south.
And then perform some very crucial experiments in our work related to understanding how this disease progresses from a completely healthy to a wasted away sea star.
Back on the beach in Unalaska, Josh Good is looking at a healthy ecosystem where sea stars are keeping the whole food chain in balance.
The Aleutians are teeming with life. There's so much life here. And everybody goes to warm places to dive. And really, like, there's way more life and biodiversity here.
Good was happy to hear that Unalaska's sea stars are safe from wasting disease for now, but he and other locals are still keeping an eye out for signs of change. Good does it every week, underwater and in his kayak. In fact, he was setting out for a paddle as soon as he put his sea stars back where he found them. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Children's Trust, working to prevent child abuse and neglect by encouraging all Alaskans to take small steps that can make a big difference in the lives of Alaska's children. Information at alaskachildrenstrust.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust. Alaska Pacific University emphasizes teaching and research that engages the region's social, cultural, environmental, and geopolitical issues. The university's Early Honors Program attracts academically advanced high school students who complete their senior year credits while also earning college credits as full-time APU students. This message sponsored by APU.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Rachel Waldholz. This week on AK, small town newspaper. The Sitka Sentinel celebrated its 75th anniversary last year without much fanfare. As many newspapers in big cities have folded or turned into online-only operations, the Sentinel steadily churns out 5 issues a week. The paper is owned and edited by Thad and Sandy Polson, journalists who arrived in Sitka in 1969 and are determined to keep the press running. KCAW's Emily Kwong has the story.
Come on back. There's something kind of interesting.
Thad Paulson is winding his way through the print shop. On our right is a giant orange machine, a printing press that was state-of-the-art when Paulson arrived in 1969 and continues to churn out every issue of the paper to this day.
It's very quiet. It doesn't make a sound.
But that's not what Paulson is excited about. He motions to the back room, his fingers covered with ink.
Things are kind of inky back here, so be careful not to touch things.
Before us is their brand new CTP machine, which stands for computer to plate. The plate works like a rubber stamp, getting covered with ink and smushed by the press onto large banks of paper. But instead of rubber, it's a giant square of aluminum.
So it's going to emerge fully developed within 3 minutes.
Thad feeds the aluminum plate into the machine. Lasers will etch the words and images of the front page onto the plate's surface. There's a story about a Coast Guard rescue and state Medicaid reform. The lead photo is of a little boy getting his head shaved for St. Baldrick's, a cancer fundraising event. Transferring his face onto the front page would have been a three-step process before, involving cutting and pasting and a lot of manual labor. With the CTP machine, that imaging process is entirely digital.
This thing takes at least an hour out of the production process.
The Sentinel's first editor was Harold Veatch in 1939. Alaska wasn't yet a state. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was president. And the reason the paper's still around, surviving the digital revolution and the folding of papers around the country, is through the steady devotion of one newspaper couple, Thad and Sandy Paulson. They have been working at the paper since 1969.
It's all we know how to do. You know, we talk about that sometimes. What if we weren't here? What if we had someone? Well, what else can we do? This is the path we've charted for ourselves, and so here we are.
And the Sentinel really is a family production. Thad and Sandy co-edit. He's 79, and she's 75. Their son, James Paulson, takes all the pictures. There are two general assignment reporters and a handful of additional staff members. In addition to copy editing all the content, Thad runs the press in the basement, just as he did when he was 36. As issues arrive hot off the press, he flicks them open to check for ink spots. When the press jams, Thad and James come to the rescue. As for Thad's wife, Sandy,
I'm looking for one more little short story to get.
She's the quarterback of the team. She decides what's going to be on the front page and chooses the wire stories and writes the headlines.
Nowadays, Sandy sits at her desk upstairs in the newsroom, calling national stories from the Associated Press with a few clicks of the mouse. But in the beginning, she was tethered to the news of the world through a single wire service that typed at 60 words a minute.
Except like five times louder.
James Paulson, who was 4 years old when his parents took over the paper, called growing up in a 1970s newsroom tumultuous.
When there was an important breaking story, a bell would go off, and I just remember when I was a kid, and the bell would go off quite a bit because it was during Watergate and lots of breaking news.
James says his parents have tried their best to keep up with technology over the years.
Dad is kind of an early adopter. I mean, he was sending out emails back when it was like sending out Morse code.
But that doesn't mean it's been easy to adapt. The CTP machine cost $50,000, which is why it took the Sentinel so long to incorporate it. But the paper is profitable. That's partly because the operation is mostly a family affair.
I wouldn't recommend it for a business model, and I'll tell you why. What if we want to move on, do something else, transfer ownership? The salaries we've been paying ourselves on the books won't cover half of what you have to pay the people who will do it in real life.
Thad and Sandy met working for City Papers in Oklahoma, but had to change their approach to reporting in Sitka. This is especially true with the obituaries, which Sandy takes particular care to write.
With age, I realize more and more the importance of having some sort of legacy or, you know, having your life on record somewhere.
It's the kind of personal touch that only a small-town newspaper can bring.
We are a daily paper in a weekly-sized town. It works very well for us, but it's the exception rather than the rule.
Within 20 minutes, the print is done, and 2,500 issues are stacked and ready for distribution. Thad looks over with a triumphant grin.
Another day, another dollar.
Thad Paulson says circulation is double what it was in the 1970s, and that as long as Sitkans still want a daily paper, he intends for the Sentinel to be around. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwonk.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Tom Irons, who's retired and lives in Homer.
I choose Alaska as my home because of the beauty, and I think the specialness of the people, and because it is close to my wilderness home. Alaska has pretty much everything that I and Jeannie want in our lives. Well, certainly foremost is spending time in complete wilderness. Every year we spend 3 to 4 months in the remote mountains of northern Alaska. And at the same time, we are blessed with the ability to balance that alone, that solitude, with a community of people that are truly wonderful to be a part of. Oh, yes, I felt like an Alaskan as I was building the first log cabin. Living in a tent, we lived in a tent for 3 months. We harvested the dead standing trees, and we found joy and a sense of the kind of life that I really loved. It touched my soul. Alaska is a tremendously huge state, and it's a very, very small community. And for me, the stories that come from community, from the people that will pick you up and take you the 200 miles you're hitchhiking because you just completed a canoe voyage down the Yukon, or the people that will stop and help you fix a flat in a snowstorm, or the generosity and caring of people in Alaska is tremendous.
Tom Irons lives in Homer. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Kwong, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Rachel Waldholz.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Emily Files in Haines, and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast offers online degree courses featuring practitioner-oriented instruction with a focus on skills for direct career application. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.